Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. What does the phrase, "Where did you go to high school," really mean? More often than not, it's a coded question designed to reveal one's economic, social, or ethnic background. We'll talk about coded language a little bit later, but first, our region's background can often be traced through its architecture. Unfortunately, much of that historic architecture exists today only in photographs or drawings or memories. Much has been lost due to time, decay, or demolition. A new exhibit at the Missouri History Museum is reminding us of the so-called lost buildings. They range from private residences to hotels, from churches to sports venues. Joining me in studio to talk about the exhibit titled The Lost Buildings of St. Louis is Andrew Wonko, public historian at the Missouri History Museum. Andrew, nice to see you. Thanks for coming in again.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay. What do we lose when we lose a historic building?
Oh, gosh. There's an open-ended question if right. I've ever heard one. You know, a lot of people think about buildings as just sort of brick and mortar. Here it is, this thing that stood for a while and it's gone. A lot of times I hear the assumption being made that when we lose buildings, something of greater or equal value is going to come in and take their place. And that's not always the case, because sometimes what we lose is so much more than the physical structure or tax dollars or something like that. It's our collective shared memory. You know, these lost buildings that we talk about in the exhibit at the Missouri History Museum, they aren't just fascinating places because of their architectural style or because they talk about St. Louis during a certain period of its history. It's really more about the collective values that St. Louis was chasing at the time when this place was built, and what does it mean? What can we learn from it? How can we learn from it both positively and negatively? What were some of the values they chased that turned out to be probably things we don't want to chase? And what were values that have become a long-term part of our collective story?
You know, it's interesting putting it that way. Give me some sense of the range of properties, if I can put it that way, buildings that you have included in the exhibit. What are the 31 different properties?
We have in the exhibit, it's in a small atrium space at the museum. It's really more of a photo gallery than a whole full-size exhibit.
Sure.
And so we were able to fit 31 different stories on the walls through printed photographs that come from our collections. They're enormous. I think the biggest one is 6 by 10 feet, so people can really get a good glimpse at these places. And then we have 30 more stories of other lost buildings on an electronic kiosk, so that's 61 total places. They range, it truly is, it's the range of the entire city's existence. Our oldest lost building is the home of our founder, city founder, Auguste Chouteau. All the way up to the San Luis apartments, which were demolished on Lindell just a few years ago in 2009.
How did you decide which of the buildings you would include in both phases of this exhibit?
Well, we have more than a million photographs in the collections at the Missouri History Museum. And so it was actually pretty difficult to narrow it down to just the 30 photographs for the walls. But when I was going through it, I really wanted to have the biggest range possible of stories, not just of timeline from colonial St. Louis all the way up to the present day, but of subject matter as well. We wanted places that were lighthearted, fun, family places like Sportsman's Park or Bush Memorial Stadium, both sports venues featured in the exhibit. But then we had places that were very hard stories to tell. Pruitt-Igoe, which debate still ranges today as to why that exactly became a lost building of St. Louis. It's a very complex story that can't be summed up in any short sense of the word by any means. It really ranges all over the place. Businesses, private residences, one-of-a-kind oddities that have no parallel in history and probably never will.
Well, let's talk for a moment about those one-of-a-kind oddities.
Sure.
to get us started. give me some sense of one or two of them.
Well, a favorite one, as I've been giving tours of this exhibit, the one that always gets the most response in the one-of-a-kind oddities section is the Coral Court Motel. I think mostly because people have their own memories and maybe some ideas of what went on there. A lot of urban legends surrounding this place. So the Coral Court Motel, of course, was on Watson Road. It opened in 1942, kind of in the heyday of Route 66. And at the time, this would have been a great place if you were driving from Tulsa or Chicago. It's a wonderful place to pull over and stop and have a good night's rest, or to do whatever else you might do in a motel that offered rooms for as short as 4 hours at a time. It's a fantastic story, not just because of what really took place there or because of the quirky automobile-inspired architecture, but because of the legend that surrounds the place, in that it was a no-tell motel where secrets remained safe and people could pull into the garages and they'd be completely hidden, both of them and their automobile, for no one to know what they were doing behind closed doors.
I think we get the picture for those who don't know about Coral Coast Motel. Yeah. And that is obviously totally gone now. But I can remember seeing it, or at least portions of it, not too many years ago.
In the early 90s, once it closed down in 1993, a group called the Coral Court Preservation Society advocated to have it placed on the National Historic Register and actually succeeded, but it was already too late. The buildings were soon torn down for a housing development.
How were most of these buildings lost? Was it through just age or what? Is there a common thread there?
We've got a couple different ways. Some were just victims of progress in a city that was always rapidly changing. The most famous one for what came after it is the Bixby Mansion. William Bixby was a philanthropist here in St. Louis. He was a two-time president of the Missouri Historical Society. He lived in what at the time was the largest private residence in St. Louis. It had 45 rooms and stood at the corner of Lindell and Kings Highway, a address most people would likely know as the address of the Chase and Park Plaza hotels. The Bixby Mansion was torn down for these two hotels to be built. Its grounds were that large that two hotels were able to fit on it. So when we talk about losing buildings, it's sometimes difficult because people, we want to save these stories from our history, but if you think about a case like the William Bixby Mansion, it came down and we lost that story, but without it coming down, we would have never had Wrestling at the Chase or the Veiled Prophet Ball or all these other stories that people, obviously the Chase is an incredible historic resource. So some were victims of progress in that sense. Others were lost to disaster. The Lindell Hotel burned down in 1867, and the Purina Mills plant burned down almost 100 years later. Both had disastrous fires.
And going through some of these stories, it seems that fire just pops up again and again as
over
being the cause of their destruction.
Right.
What's the old Southern Hotel? Is that the was that the, my do the, I have that right?
Yes, the Southern Hotel. Yeah. That's probably one of the big stories of the exhibit. That's I would say is fairly well known, but to a lot of St. Louisans, they wouldn't know anything about it because it's been long since gone. The Southern Hotel really marked the reemergence of the stylish, swanky hotels of St. Louis after the Civil War. It opened in December 1865, and it was this really fantastic place, visiting dignitaries and celebrities. Mark Twain was a frequent guest there, the governor of Missouri. It was run by Robert Campbell, whose home is now – his home is the only not lost building of Lucas Place, the Campbell House Museum. But disaster was lurking in its future. On April 11th, 1877, a fire started in the hotel's basement that spread upwards through the floors, leaving people trapped on the fifth floor. And the city of St. Louis gained an unlikely hero that day in an Irish firefighter named Phelim O'Toole. He strapped two wobbly ladders together and put them up against the side of the hotel and climbed all the way up to the fifth floor to rescue people.
A very famous name indeed in St. Louis history. Let's just stop there for a moment with regard to the hotel. What does the hotel tell us about St. Louis at that time? I know it was upper scale because of the people you mentioned who visited there. But what else do we know about it that gives us another sense of the history?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly upper scale is an interesting interesting thought. St. Louis, by 1877, that's just 3 years after the Eads Bridge opens, it's kind of coming down off of its steamboat days. But those days really changed St. Louis in some unimaginable ways to people who had been living there just 20 or 30 years earlier. It had truly become a riverside metropolis with a very diverse population. From 1860 to 1900, St. Louis's black population would increase 10 times over. Germans and Irish would flood into the city on steamboats. It became a very multicultural city. And in the process, you have some very interesting people who kind of rise up in the city, and you get a lot of interest in what's going on here.
I know the population was very diverse, but from what you've been able to determine through this exhibit and others that you've been involved in, was the city relatively affluent at the time?
I think there were opportunities for affluence, yeah. But to say that everybody here was affluent...
Well, I wouldn't suggest that everybody was.
But I think St. Louis offered a lot of possibility. People like William Bixby, who I mentioned earlier, his home, he was brought here as a teenager because he showed strong work ethic to work for the Union Pacific Railroad, and he eventually became a lumber buyer for the American Car and Foundry Company and worked his way up to retirement by age 48. Those kind of opportunities existed, but for others, very little opportunity could be found. If you were a poor migrant laborer, it was rough times in St. Louis.
I suppose that story held true in most of the cities of the time.
Of course, Cincinnati, Chicago.
No question about it. Right. You mentioned Pruitt-Igoe a moment ago, and I was surprised to see that on the list because it's only been gone for 25 years, maybe a little bit more than that, 35, 40 years maybe by
right.
now. Yeah, and it was built in the 1950s. You say it's a complicated story. Did you come to any conclusions about Pruitt-Igoe through your research?
Well, so Pruitt-Igoe came down just 20 years or so after it was built. It had been seen as this shining example of the future of urban living, and within 20 years had sort of descended into catastrophe. And there are a number of reasons why, federal housing programs, some people would blame the architectures. And so in this exhibit, we focused only on the blame that was placed on the architecture because it's about lost buildings of St. Louis. And so many critics who see the architecture's failings as causing its decline, some of the things they talk about are the wide open galleries that Pruitt-Igoe had. They were meant to inspire friendly gathering space, but really it became a no man's land that no one took care of. Skip-stop elevators that would only stop every third floor, meant to inspire people to walk up and down the stairs and greet their neighbors, made stairways predatory grounds that people could not escape from. But that's just one small piece of that enormous story that stretches. I mentioned some of these places where they stretch beyond the boundaries of St. Louis in their importance, and that Pruitt-Igoe is one example of a national issue that took place.
There was a crime problem there too, as most
right.
of us know. It's funny, it brings back memories to me because they imploded the first building there, and I was there. In the television days,
yeah.
we took pictures of that building coming down. The first time I'd ever seen a building imploded like that.
Right.
It didn't take very long.
No.
it didn't take very long. We're talking with Andrew Wonko from the Missouri History Museum. We're talking about the latest exhibit at the museum, which deals with the lost buildings of St. Louis. We'll come back and continue our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. If you'd like to send us an email, that is, do so at talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL On Air. This is St. Louis On the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Andrew Wonko. Andrew, what do you hope will be the takeaway of visitors to the museum who see this exhibit?
I think the takeaway here is that, I mean, obviously St. Louis is a place with an incredible built environment. You can hardly walk down a street without coming to some corner with a fantastic story waiting to be seen on it. But so many more of those fascinating stories have long since been lost from our physical environment. You know, the buildings are no more, so the stories kind of fall to the wayside, and it's easy to lose them. We want to reacquaint people with these stories and get them to revisit places that can't be visited anymore and kind of think twice about the built environment that surrounds them.
Do you ever get caught up in the notion that this is progress after all? I mean, there's an inevitability about this sort of thing.
Well, like I mentioned, it certainly is difficult that the case of the William Bixby home, we wouldn't have the Chase Park Plaza Hotel if the home had stood. But at the same time, there's a lot of other buildings that we feature that they're victims of, to be honest, nothing more than short-sightedness. The Marquette Hotel that stood on Washington Avenue, it was the hotel for for all of the garment manufacturers up and down Washington. It was torn down in 1988 for a 75-spot car lot. Mm. And that's, you know, can you imagine a 10-story building on Washington Avenue, what it contributes today? So it's just there's a huge range, and it's really case by case.
It reminds me of what was lost downtown when they cleared a lot of the land down there for the arch.
Of course, yeah. One of St. Louis's most beloved symbols. At the same time, it also took out a very large portion of our historic city. But those things are complicated. You know, at the time, nobody saw a future in the riverfront, and they saw a future in the arch. It's very tough.
Where are we now with regard to saving some of those historic buildings that remain? I think I'll just take as an example the Wainwright Building, for instance, very historic.
Right.
It's not going anywhere, presumably, but how do we assure that it does not?
Well, one of the great things we did with this exhibit was we were able to partner with the Landmarks Association of St. Louis, who actually did save the Wainwright when it almost did go somewhere back in the 70s. We took from Landmarks, they published their annual Most Endangered and Most Enhanced Buildings list. And so we wanted this exhibit to have just a little bit of preservation in it so people could hear about important way being made in towards the future of buildings not joining the ranks of the lost buildings of St. Louis. So we added some of the most endangered buildings that tend to end up on their list over and over again. The St. Louis Palladium, which is a crucial link in the city's music history. The Clemens Mansion on Cass Avenue. And then we also added buildings that have made the leap from most endangered to most enhanced, which is my favorite. You know, that's the uplifting moment when you can see that some of these places are being saved. And very important, very large buildings like the City Hospital near Lafayette Square.
So would it be possible, again, I'll take an example of the area downtown around the Arch. Would it be possible for something like that to happen again, for those buildings simply to be erased?
Well, these kind of things, it's always easy to say hindsight. You know, looking back, it's very very easy to make these sort of calls. But, of course, the Rams football stadium that's proposed has caused a lot of uprising in preservation communities because it shows all the remaining historic buildings along North Broadway being torn down.
And we're also discovering that the planned footprint is over an Indian burial ground, sacred Indian ground, which could have some ramifications down the line.
Right.
Let's take a call. Jonathan joins us from St. Louis. Jonathan, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yes, I have comments actually about two buildings. One is Pruitt-Igoe, and I'm a little disappointed that you seem to concentrate only on the architecture, if you can blame the architecture. With the Coral Courts, you made a big deal about the sociology, but there's been a lot written about Pruitt-Igoe in terms of how the sociology was even more important in the architecture, and you really can't blame the architecture. There's actually been a movie made about Pruitt-Igoe called The Pruitt-Igoe Myth. I think came out about 3 years ago. And it would be really a good thing if the History Museum could sponsor showings of that so people could get the real story and not just concentrate on blaming the architecture. I'm not sure exactly who made the movie, but you should probably be able to find it easily. I've seen it in two different cities now. The other thing I'd like to say is about some architecture that's being unnecessarily destroyed right now. It's not a building per se, but it's the Museum of Westward Expansion underneath the Arch. And the National Park Service and the City Arch River people are planning a new museum. But there was no reason that they had to destroy the older museum, which was a masterpiece of both architecture, interior design, and history. So in a sense, we're destroying history two different ways. We're destroying an important part of our built environment, and we're destroying a historical exhibit, which I would have thought, you know, someone like the History Museum would have supported. And
Jonathan, right. Thank you for the call. Our time is starting to get away, and I want to give Andrew a chance to respond. I'd like to point out that we've all seen the Pruitt-Igoe film. We did a program on it here, and he's obviously very, very right. The sociological aspects of this are terrifically important.
So we do have regular showings of that film, and it is incredible. One of the things, he's absolutely right. The architecture is just one small piece, and oftentimes is misquoted as what was ultimately the problem was this sociological shift that was taking place in America at the time. But in these sort of exhibits, we have about 150 words to talk about each of these buildings. Mm-hmm. And if you want to try to do that with Pruitt-Igoe, you certainly be my guest, because it's very difficult.
Yeah. I just want to mention that we've had a couple of people email us to talk about places. I don't believe there's even included in your exhibit. The Bethlehem Lutheran School on Salisbury near North Florissant is one that comes to mind. Does that ring any bells with you?
I know the Bethlehem Lutheran Church, I know, just collapsed about a year or two ago up in Hyde Park.
Yeah. And the other one here is from Barbara, writes about the Granada Theater on Gravois, which is very, very well known. A lot of memories. I mean, some of these buildings that are not long gone are still very vivid in the memory of people who grew up with them.
Right.
You have a couple of restaurants cited.
Oh, yes.
Give me some sense of the kind of places you're talking about.
One of my favorites is Tony Faust's Oyster House, and that's a name a lot of people with an interest in St. Louis history will recognize. Tony Faust was easily the most well-known restaurant in St. Louis and possibly the entire American West in the late 1800s. He served the finest delicacies at his restaurant, which was connected to the Southern Hotel, which we talked about earlier. It was just really an incredible place, and he turned it into this jewel box of delicacy. He had a rooftop patio with trellises and trees and all sorts of things. He was great friends with Adolphus Busch, and Anheuser-Busch even brewed their own special line of Faust beer to be served only at his restaurant, and his daughter would go on to marry one of Adolphus Busch's – or his son would go on to marry one of Adolphus Busch's daughters. Hmm. Incredible story. Yeah.
How about theaters?
Theaters, we also have a few. One of the most well-known for people with personal memories is probably the Ambassador Theater. My own mom was telling me about.
Not long gone.
Right. I think she said she saw the Eagles or someone there back in the 70s. Yeah. And the Ambassador was an incredible structure, stood downtown. It was a theater on the bottom floor, and it had 11 or 12 stories of offices built on top of the theater. And when they finally tore it down for a corporate bank plaza in 1996, the steel beam holding up the roof of the theater was so large that it took like 13 tractor trailers to pull the thing out of there.
I think that's where the expression, they don't build them like that anymore, came from. Let's take another quick call as time allows. Mike in St. Louis, go ahead, but make it quick, please, Mike.
Sure. Hi, Don.
Hi.
The Peavey Dairy, what's going to happen to that on the corner of Shoto? And they took down the sign, which I thought was a shame because it's iconic. But the building is still there, and I'm wondering, are they going to keep that building, or what are they going to do with that?
That's a good question. I always, whenever I drive past it, I think, can you imagine if they turned it into student lofts, the view these students would have looking out over downtown? I think the answer is no one really knows at this point.
Yeah. But there's certainly a lot of buildings and properties out there that we want to preserve. And going through all of this, obviously you had to discount some buildings because you only have limited space and what have you. And anything memorable that you wished were included that can't be?
One place that we didn't include that's one of my favorite stories about St. Louis would be one of the buildings of Hop Alley, which was the original Chinatown of St. Louis. That it was replaced by a Busch Stadium parking garage in the 60s. We just didn't quite have the space, and we had so many other buildings that we were trying to cram in there, and we didn't end up getting one in.
Of those that are included, what would be your favorite and why?
One of my favorites, because it's such a strange story from history, is the Jack Daniel's Distillery of St. Louis. Prohibition came to the state of Tennessee about 10 years before it came to the rest of the nation. And so when that happened and Tennessee went dry, Jack Daniel's owner Lem Motlow moved the entire distilling operation to St. Louis, which was possibly the wettest place you can imagine. And it became a target for gangsters during Prohibition. They had 30,000 gallons of pre-Prohibition Prohibition whiskey stored there that it was just a bullseye for people waiting to steal.
And, you know, when we think of St. Louis during Prohibition, before or after, we think of beer. We don't often think of the hard stuff. I had never heard that story before. It's fascinating. Well, Andrew Wonka, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It sounds like a fascinating exhibit. We want to get over and see it. You, of course, are with the Missouri History Museum. That's what we're talking about, the exhibit that's going to be taking place there. It's already underway and will continue through the 19th of July, correct?
Yes.
You should have a good turnout. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, speaking in code. Most of us probably do it, especially when talking about race. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.